Good day, everybody, and welcome to today's Internet Seminar on Green Remediation, sponsored by the Green Remediation Subcommittee of EPA's Engineering Forum. My name is Julie Santiago, and I'm a Remedial Project Manager for the EPA Region 4 office in Atlanta, Georgia. I will be moderating today's session titled Green Remediation, Applying Strategies in the Field, Session 1 of 3. Our seminars, the second, will be held on November 12th, and the third will be December 15th. We will get started in a few minutes. While we wait for others to log on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping issues. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar, specific URL, which is in front page of today's seminar. If you have not checked in today's seminar, please take a moment to do so. The front page also contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included pictures and short bio sketches of... Please note that the presenter's email address are hot links on that page in case you have any questions for them after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone line, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have a question and answer session after each of the presentations, at which point you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask your questions. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now, hit star 6 to place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer session, you can hit pound 6 to unmute the phone. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive of the call. Again, keep us on mute. Please do not put us on hold. For those of you online, you should have clicked on the agenda for today's to-go session icon and should be on the slide number 1 presentation. The main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. You may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide. You need not to wait until the question answer period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshooting your problem. The presenter will be announced the number of slides to which he or she is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As I stated earlier, we will have a question and answer session after each presentation. I would like you to bring your attention to the additional resources link at the bottom of the front page, where we have assembled a series of documents, databases, and websites directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the link page and online feedback form, we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email for feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Lastly, this event will be recorded and archived, including websites. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you will be able to download in several formats or replay online. So subscribe to CLUIN podcast to receive new archive seminars as they become available. www.schoolin.org/live. Let's kick off this session. Hope that everybody's hearing me. Okay. In June of this year, EPA held its annual National Association of Remedial Chronic Managers meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, that are known as NARPAM, and one of the most attended sessions was the Green Remediation. Because of its success, members of the EPA's Technical Support Project Engineering Forum have taken this full-day session and bring it back in a number of same talks as online seminars this winter. This is the first of the three sessions. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remedial strategy, for example, the remedy selected, and the implementation approach early in the process, and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition, debris and recycling. Others are still emerging, including use of renewable energy sources such as wind and solar to power remedial systems. Over the three sessions, the online training introduces you to the key technical, policy, and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn over to our first of the three speakers today, I remind everybody in the phone lines to put us on mute. Do not put us on hold. Hit star 6 and please do not put us on hold. Thank you. Today's first speaker is Mr. Sam Wells. He is, will be talking about headquarters and cross-program perspectives to us today. Before I introduce Suzanne, I wanted to call to everybody's attention that her presentation didn't get to us on time. So her presentation is going to appear in as part of the link to additional resources. You might be able to download it right now, or maybe you can access it later on for references. So I apologize for the inconvenience, as Jim Ballen said before, and if you're interested in her presentation, you can download her presentation anytime. Let me give you a brief bio of Suzanne. Suzanne Wells is the Director of Superfund Community Involvement and Program Initiatives Branch. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Science from the Texas Christian University and MS degree in Technology and Human Affairs for the Washington University. Suzanne has been with the EPA for 26 years, the past 23 in the Superfund program. Suzanne is leading National Air Force as the co-chair for the Superfund Green Remediation Workgroup. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Julie. I apologize that the slides are not up, but Jean Valent will make them available as soon as possible after the seminar today. I'm just going to go over a few things. Julie started out by giving us a good definition of green remediation, and what I'm going to cover are some of the green remediation efforts that are going on across the agency right now, and talking specifically about what has been going on in Superfund. I think to add to what Julie said about green remediation, there are really six themes that we look at in green remediation. I think we tend to think of it in terms of saving energy and energy efficiency, but energy is really just one of the six themes. We also are core elements of green remediation. We also look at what we can do to reduce emissions to the air, what we can do to conserve water at sites. Also, what can be done to minimize any disturbances to the soil or the habitat in the area of the site. Anything that we can do to minimize materials and waste generation throughout the cleanup. And also it looks, I think, at long-term stewardship in terms of how we can overall reduce greenhouse gas emissions from our cleanups and what we can do to increase public awareness of the long-term stewardship at the site. And actually, Jean just posted this graphic that displays the six key elements, and it's on slide four. There are a lot of things going on right now at the agency and across the federal government with green remediation and trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In August of this year, the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, which is over all of the waste programs at EPA, issued a Green Cleanups Principles document. In early September of this year, the Superfund program released a green remediation strategy. It currently is up on the Superfund website, and we are accepting comments on the strategy from the public through November 16th. There's also an effort underway where EPA staff from Region 3 are participating in an effort with ASTM to develop voluntary green cleanup standards and certification system. In addition, our Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response has a Repower America's Land initiative that is trying to encourage the use of contaminated lands for renewable energy generation siting. And then we have many regional initiatives that are going on right now. In the Superfund programs, regions 2, 8, and 10 have all released their own versions of green remediation or clean and green policies. And there is much work going on across the agency. One thing I will also mention is that on October 5th, President Obama signed a new executive order that directs all federal agencies to set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from buildings and from vehicles, and it also includes targeting the work of government contractors. And in that government executive order, there's a goal right now of reducing our emissions by 20% from the 2010 levels within 10 years. So there is an awful lot going on and a lot of interest in this area. With the OSWER, this is the waste program-wide green remediation principles that were issued in August. They just have some very basic things that they set forth that green remediation policies will that we will, in adopting green remediation policies, protect human health and the environment while we're doing it. We will also comply with all applicable laws and regulations, that we will do our regular consultation with communities regarding response actions that we will take at sites that may include green remediation practices, and that we will consider the anticipated future land use of the site as we're looking at green remediation. The Superfund strategy falls within those OSWER green remediation principles. The strategy that we released in September covers three major areas. They deal with policy and guidance, with resource development and program implementation, and with evaluation. And I'll very briefly go through, there are 10 key action items that fall within these three major areas. In the policy and guidance area, one of the things that we are working to do right now is just to simply clarify what the role of green remediation is in remedy selection, and to, I think, convey and communicate how this fits in with our existing statutory and regulatory requirements. In the area of resource development and program implementation, this is actually where most of our key action items fall. We are doing a number of things in this area. The first covers developing a lot of tools for site managers to help them integrate green remediation practices at their sites. We're also looking at ways to develop program incentives that can encourage the use of green remediation. We have a separate topic that's looking at ways to reduce air pollutants and diesel emissions, because we have a lot of heavy equipment out at our sites that uses diesel fuel, and we're looking at what we can do to reduce the emissions from that equipment. We also are doing a number of pilot projects so that we can get and gain more experience with green remediation and demonstrate their application at sites. Excuse me. We're also working to establish incentives to encourage our contractors, our assistance agreement recipients, and others to use green remediation practices. And finally, within this overall area of resource development and program implementation, we're looking at how to communicate and share the success stories that we're learning as we're using green remediation at sites. The third policy area that we're looking at is evaluation. And this honestly is an area that I think is going to present some very big challenges for us. It's very difficult today to get a baseline of what our energy usage is at sites. It's not something we've routinely tracked in the past. I think estimates that have been made of energy usage in the program have been extrapolated from a few sites. So what we are doing is we're trying to get a better handle and evaluate green remediation more at the site level, to try to, I think, enrich the data that we currently have and to help us get a better overall program estimate of the energy that we use so that we will be able to evaluate and measure the impacts from implementing changes with our green remediation strategy. Within this evaluation piece, we are working to develop some program evaluation measures so we can measure our progress at implementing the strategy. And we're also evaluating the overall implementation of the strategy. There are lots of activities already underway. There are multiple cross-agency and regional work groups. I would refer everybody to the CLUIN website. There's actually a list of the different work groups across the agency that are have been operating for quite some time. We have been working very closely with groups such as the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable, with ITRC, with our colleagues at ASWAMO who are doing some great work on green remediation. We are working with the Engineering Forum, with our enforcement program on their environmentally responsible reduce and reuse initiative. We're working closely with our contracts office on trying to develop model contract language. And we currently are working on developing a number of short reference fact sheets on the use of green remediation at different types of sites to try to help, I think, jumpstart some of the green remediation practices at sites. There's also a tremendous amount of information already available on green remediation. I would refer you once again to the CLUIN website. That is the primary source of and location for all of the green remediation material that EPA is developing. We also have a website on Superfund right now that if you just go to the Superfund website and do /green remediation, you will find our green remediation policy, and you'll also have a link to CLUIN on it. Julie has mentioned this seminar today has grown out of a NARPM seminar. We have been giving training at both NARFM and OSC Readiness for several years now on green remediation. There are a lot of site managers that are really innovators in this field, so we have a lot of regional leadership in this area. You'll also find up on the CLUIN website a contracting toolkit that has a lot of information on how to incorporate green remediation practices into our EPA contracts. And finally, we are also doing a number of pilots this year that we announced and funded at the end of last fiscal year, where we're looking to promote work on life cycle cost assessments and just testing out various innovative green remediation strategies. So that's the end of my introductory remarks. Julie, I don't know if you want to move right now into the case study presentation.
No. Thanks, Suzanne. I'd like to open it for questions. Let me get a question from the phone line. Anybody has a question?
If you've muted your phone line, simply hit #6 to unmute your line.
Any questions for Suzanne? So I'm checking to see if there's any questions online, but there's only one, but it's in reality somebody needing help, Eric Ruder. I don't know if Jean is going to be able to help.
Yes, Julie, anything that comes online for the technical stuff, you can ignore. Our support staff will catch those people.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let's proceed to the second topic today. It's going to be the regional roundtable session, and I'm going to be presenting it. As I said before, I'm a remedial project manager for the EPA Region 4 in Atlanta, Georgia, and I've been with the Superfund program for the past 12 years as an RPM. And just as a bio for myself, I have a BS degree in chemical engineering from the University of Puerto Rico Engineering Campus, and I've been with the EPA for the last 18 years. As Suzanne, I'm also involved with the Superfund Green Remediation Workgroup and the Engineering Forum, and also the Engineering Forum Green Remediation Subcommittee, the Elsewhere Communications and Metric Workgroups, and other Elsewhere groups that are related to green remediation as well. In addition to that, I'm also the Regional Lead Representative for NARFM. But today, I'm going to be talking to you about what Region 4 has been doing regarding green remediation for the last year. I am going to refer you to slide number 1 of the presentation. As I said, I'm the Region 4 Superfund Green Remediation Coordinator. Then let's move to slide number 2. For the last year, what Region 4 has decided to tackle on is what we call the Region 4 Supplemental RIFS Guidance. For those that don't know, RIFS means Remedial Investigation Feasibility Studies. It's one of the earliest processes of the Superfund process. And one of the things that we have all studied and seen across all the presentations that we've hearing recently is the definition that we have for green remediation. And I want to point out that as Suzanne was saying before, the definition that we have is the practice of considering all environmental effects of a cleanup during each phase of the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental cleanup action. Well, what Region 4 has done is that we have taken that portion that says the effects of a cleanup during each phase of the process. So what we are doing is looking into one portion of the Superfund process, in this case, the RIFS, and we are looking into what ways we can incorporate sustainability throughout that process. If we move on to slide number 3. This is a slide that you have seen before, too. One of the things that we use from the beginning is definitely the primer, and that's our guideline for sustainability and green remediation. One of the things that we have taken out of this is the practices and examples that they provide within the primer, and the regulatory frameworks that they talk about. If you haven't seen it, here is a link to get a copy of the green remediation primer. We can move on to slide number 4, and I'm pretty sure you have seen this slide before as well, and this is the core elements for green remediation: energy, air, water, lands and ecosystem, materials and waste, and stewardship. One of the things that early on we tackle is how do we incorporate sustainability within of each of these core elements. And we have to make a definition of how within the process we're going to be addressing each of these core elements. I wanted to mention also that these core elements are aligned with the EPA mandate, Executive Order 13423, which was signed a couple of years by President Bush, and also this week the President Obama has issued another executive order that is augmenting the extent of this previous executive order. And we are taking that into consideration as well. It's just that when we prepared the presentation, we didn't have the executive order yet. We can move to the next slide, number 5. Talking about our regional efforts about sustainability, we have done is we have contracted out Black & Veatch to work with us to produce something that we are calling the sustainability work assignments. One of the things that we did from the beginning is that we divided the work in 3 stages: the literature research, which we did a technical memo and was completed on March 23 of 2009, and which incorporated everything that is out there in regards to each of the core elements. So the way that it's done is that if you have a copy of the electronic version, you're going to be able to link in all the sources. And what we're going to be doing is that after we finish this presentation, I'm going to send a copy to Jean Balance so she can put it in the sources link for this website, and you're going to be able to download it later on when you download this presentation in Cluin. And the good thing about it is that I think it's a good resource for you if you have no idea how to start to green remediation, or if you think that you want to get some information in a certain topic. You're going to be able to go directly to a link and find out about all the information that is available out there. Going to slide number 6. The second portion of the green, the RIFS sustainability work assignment is that we developed what we called a green remediation training or primer 101. We took the primer that is appears on Cluin, and we developed a 1-hour training session for people that are interested in getting acquainted with green remediation. We did have 2 sessions of the training, and in April 13 of 2009 here in the region as part of the joint branch meetings. And also we did another presentation using the same presentation, the same training, on June 23rd of 2009 in a DOE, EPA, and State Environmental Conference here in Atlanta, Georgia. And it was very well accepted. Actually, Region 6 had contacted me recently, and we gave them a copy of the training because they are doing a compilation of the trainings that are available regarding green remediation. So I'm going to put that presentation as well as one of the sources links that you're going to be able to download later on if you're interested in using that kind of presentation in any level that you want. Let's move on to slide number 7. The second portion of disability work assignment, we call it the second technical memorandum. What we did at that stage is that we started to incorporate sustainability within the RIFS process, and we did the first draft in July 10th of 2009, and we opened it for our peer review then for the regions, and we have received all the feedback. We have incorporated them in our next deliverable that actually was released 2 days ago. Slide number 8. As I said, in this slide here, it says that is under development, but actually we released it for peer review on October 6th of this week. And again, we are asking for comments, and this is actually open for EPA internal peer review only at this moment. And we are asking comments to everybody back to me by November 6th of this year. And hopefully what we are trying to accomplish with this document is that based on the first round of comments that we received on July, some of the people actually asked me that if there's a possibility of bringing this as a document instead of being a regional document to be in the national level. So what I'm looking for this time in this round of comments is to see what are the things that EPA across all the regions think that we should do to make this document one of national level. We have thought that probably this could be a live document, that since there's so much going on and we are moving so fast in the green remediation arena, that maybe we're going to make of this a live document that we're going to be able to update from time to time. But it is very important for everybody that has got a copy of the document to review it, look at it, tell me what you think, if it's good, bad, and if you have any comments, I really, really appreciate it if you can send it to me. And my contact appears also in the cluing first page when you were prompted to this seminar. So moving on to slide number 9. After we talk about how much comments we received and what kind of comments we received, what we think that the next step is going to be to develop training based on this supplemental RIFS guidance. And what we have talked already is that maybe we're going to do sort of like a dry run with RPMs only webinars sometime between January or February. And then whatever comes out of that presentation to the web, we are going to develop a training for NARPOM 2010. And I think that's going to be a portion of the Engineering Forum Green Remediation Subcommittee Green Remediation Training for NARPOM. And then if we move to slide number 10, other thing that I want to talk about, following the lead of regions 2, 9, 10, and recently, I believe, number 6, they developed their own clean and green policy. Well, region 4 has decided to develop their own clean and green policy as well. And right now is being drafted, and it's about to be signed. Actually, it has gone through a few rounds of comments, and I expect that probably it's going to be signed within probably the next 2 weeks. And as soon as it is available, I will make a copy and post it in our website and most likely also in the Cluing website. So I'll keep everybody posted on that regard. Also, other things that we are thinking at this point also that we have already talked about is that since we already tackled the RIFS process in the Superfund process, now the next step will be to tackle the RDRA. So we're thinking that sometime during fiscal year 2010, we're going to be starting another work assignment to tackle the RDRA process. And I know that there's a lot of people that are doing very interesting things, and we are very eager to find out what you guys are doing out there, if there's something that definitely is part of a green action, if it saves you money because it's green or something. We would like to hear about it. And if you have an interesting story or you have a site that you would like for us to look at, to study and probably adapt a couple of the things that you have developed or using your site, I would like to hear about it, and you can always email me, and we will probably start looking into that sometime in January and February to start gathering that kind of information. And that concludes my portion of the presentation. I was wondering, we'd like to open it for questions, if there's anybody in the phone lines that have a question.
Julie, we had a few questions that came in online.
Online, yes.
If you'd like, those of you on the phone lines, again, it's #6 to unmute your line. But while we're waiting for any of those, if there's a phone line question, I'm just going to start with the ones that came in online. The first one comes in from Omaha, and they ask, in reference to slide number 6, who was the organization that was collecting training?
Yes, Region 6 is producing sort of like a database, and they are going to provide that to the state, and they're collecting any kind of information that is existent regarding training on green remediation. And I believe you can contact Raji Joshiam, probably she'll be able to give you more information. I don't know if she's in the line, though.
Okay, great. We'll be sure to put Raji's contact information as well when we update today's seminar information. The next question, though, that came in online also comes from Omaha, and they ask, in reference to slides number 7 and 8, are there courtesy copies of the draft documents available outside EPA?
No, right now we are not releasing any draft documents yet. I would like for the documents to go through this round of comments, because if we are going to bring this document to a national level, I would like to get more input from all the regions and headquarters, and also our legal folks in headquarters.
Okay, great. That's the end of the online questions. One last attempt for anyone on the phone lines. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Let's go to our third speaker today. Is Clint Sperry. He's a remedial project manager for EPA Region 7 Superfund program. He has been with the agency for more than 18 years, working as a chemist, a record inspector, and an air inspector and stack tester. Most of the Superfund sites he works are on federal facilities. Some of those include Lake City Army Ammunition Plant, Whiteman Air Force Base, Fort Leonard Wood, National Geospace Agency, Tyson Valley Powder Farm, and the Jefferson Barracks. Prior to his experience with the EPA, Mr. Sperry was an environmental scientist with Mantec Technology. He provided support to Region 7 Full Containment Lab by comparing and implementing methods to destroy dioxins and other hazardous materials. Mr. Sperry currently serves as a member on the Federal Facilities Forum and the Green Remediation Workgroup, the Green Cleanup Standards Workgroup, the Response Support Corps, and is a National Radiation Task Force leader. Welcome, Clint.
Thank you, everybody. Can everyone hear me okay? Hope so.
Yes, fine.
Okay, thanks. I think I've only been in RPM for a couple of years, and so I guess being new at the program, everyone called it, I guess I must be green. So somehow, since I'm the green guy, I started doing green remediation. As it was said, almost all my facilities are federal facilities, and I think a lot of that is because I had some prior military, and so I was actually really excited to have a couple of these facilities. slide two talks about Lake City Army Ammunition Plant. Actually, it's a government-owned, contractor-operated facility. It's about 20 miles east of Kansas City, Missouri. It started in 1941 for producing bullets and ammunition for the war at the time. They are the number one supplier of ammunition for the military at this time. Since 1941, they've produced over 100 billion pieces of ammo. Primarily, they manufacture the 5.56, which is the M16 bullet, 7.62, which is the fully automatic, and the 50 cal and the 20 millimeter. It's roughly on about 4,000 acres. I was actually really excited how this piece, this facility won, because it's the federal government's the largest producer or polluter of the land, and there's billions of dollars spent right now every year to clean up hazardous waste that has been put into the ground or in the groundwater. It is also actually really close to where I grew up, so I was pretty excited about that. Slide number 13. There's an aerial shot. Area 18 will be the primary area that we're going to be talking about. It's not shown designated, but it's basically under the word aerial. There's a patch of land that's about 160 acres, and that's the primary area we're going to talk about. But that's about 4,000 acres, the whole site that you see in front of you. Slide number 14. Lake City Army Ammunition Plant was put on the national priority list in 1987. There was about 40 plus years, Lake City pretty much relied on lagoons, landfills, and burn pits for all their waste disposal. Pretty much nothing was sent off site. Everything was just thrown on the ground or burned. There's approximately 48 areas of concern. They were split into four different operable units. The first one, which is the primary one, the installation-wide operable unit. Area 18, which is the one we're going to talk about, that's about 167 acres. The northeast corner operable unit, there's about 240 acres there. Northeast corner actually has a lot of green remediation going on. I won't talk about it in depth, but there was a landfill. There's three solvent pits. There were two open burning, open detonation propellants and for propellants and pyrotex. And some of the bio that's going on right now, we put in five in-situ reactive zone mines for bioreductive dechlorination. Basically, that's when the solvent ferments and it supports bacteria growth, which in turn dechlorinates the solvents by using up the hydrogen as food. It also has a phytoremediation. There's about 5 acres of phytoremediation going on top of the landfill cap. And there's also about a 350-foot, 40-deep PRB, permeable reactive barrier wall that the phytoremediation, that the trees sit on. So, you know, there's a lot of green remediation going on at this site, and so the military is actually has a lot of grants going on right now looking at green remediation, solar, bio, just about anything you can think of, they're at least looking at it, and it's exciting because it's coming down from headquarters, so they're actually very supportive of this. Slide number 15. The history of Area 18, it's located on the northern boundary. It's about 167 acres. It started in 1950s. It began as a burning and disposal of grease, oil, solvents, paint, and just the regular plant trash, demolition trash, things like that. There's 8 surface impoundments. There were 8 surface impoundments and 15 burning pits. Slide number 16. The hydrology of Area 18, it's located in the alluvial flats. Groundwater can be located as shallow as 8 to 12 feet. The shallow groundwater is 0 to 32 feet below ground surface. It's primarily silt and clay. Water-bearing unit. The intermediate zone is 32 to 65 feet below ground surface, which is the upper half of the paleo channel. It's also called the Lake City Aquifer. It's primarily sand. And then the deep channel is of the paleo channel is 65 to 95 feet. And and it's basically the lower half of the paleo channel down to the bedrock. Bedrock actually fluctuates a little bit, but anywhere between 65 and 90 feet is where bedrock is. Slide number 17. The primary contaminants were lead, PCBs, VOCs in soil, and VOCs in groundwater. There's approximately 1 million to 2 million pounds of VOC mass, which is NAPL, at less than 30 feet below ground surface. The soil, we had hits as high as 13,000 parts per million of lead, and TCE in the soil was 9,000 parts per million. The groundwater, the highest hits we had actually, it shows 800, we had actually over 900,000 parts per billion, and that's total VOCs. Most of those was cis-1,2-DCE, but we definitely had a lot of high hits of TCE too. Slide number 18. It's kind of hard to see. I apologize for that. But the green circle on the left is called AOC1 and North Pit, and the green circles on the right is AOC2 and AOC3. Primarily the AOC1 and North Pit. Now this is actually, these are total chlorinated solvent in parts per billion, located around 30 to 60 feet below ground surface. There weren't real, AOC2 and AOC3 are the areas where they were the really, really high hits, but AOC1 and the North Pit had hits as high, over 10,000 parts per billion of total VOCs. AOC2 and 3 had, there was a hit in one of the groundwater monitoring wells of 800,000, over 800,000. Another one over 900,000, actually 979,000 parts per billion. Another monitoring well had 200,000, another of 100,000. So, and these are right in the source area. Slide number 19. We installed the remedy around 2007. The remedy that was decided upon was 3 extraction wells pumping at about 500,000 gallons per day. There was going to be a soil excavation of the soil area, and that was down to just under 3 feet. There was going to be focused in situ stabilization of the lead of the impacted soil, and basically what we were going to do, we were going to mix the soil with a binding agent called MacTite, and then we were going to put a vegetative cover on top of that. Slide number 20. We were also going to install an in situ reactive zone barrier. That's that bioreductive dechlorination. What that is basically is that we're injecting about between a 2 and a 4% molasses in there to enhance the bacteria's growth. We're going to install 130 injection wells in the shallow groundwater and 29 injection wells in the paleo channel. That's both the 30 to 60 and the 60 to 90 feet. And we are also going to install NAPL recovery wells. Now those NAPL recovery wells are these solar sippers that we're going to talk about later. And we installed 5 of those. We're also going to do monitored natural attenuation and install land use controls. Slide number 21. It's a conceptual illustration of the dissolution estimate of the NAPL. It just shows one of the 17R, which is an extraction well. There's actually 3 of them. One of them is north, one of them is west, and one of them is basically between the two AOCs, AOC1 and AOC2 and 3. I didn't talk too much about the boundaries or groundwater flow. But the northern boundary is only about 500 yards from where this area 18 is. And if we wouldn't have installed these extraction wells, the groundwater flows mostly to the north and to the west. And so to keep the contamination of the plume on site, we installed these extraction wells. Slide number 22. the AOC one and the North Pit, the NAPL, the residual NAPL is that green line, and that's approximately 100,000 parts per billion or higher. And we got that information from boring logs, and it's approximately 14,000 square feet in size. The orange line on the North Pit is about 2,500 square feet in size, and again, that's also from actual NAPL, not residual NAPL, from the boring logs. Same with AOC-1. The green is the residual at about 6,100 square feet, and the NAPL is about 4,400 square feet. Slide number 23. This is AOC 2 and 3. The green line, again, is 100,000 parts per billion of residual NAPL, representing about 123,000 square feet in size. And then the orange line is the NAPL at about 52,000 square feet in size. And again, that's where they had the highest hits, approximately 100, 200, 800, and 900,000 parts per billion of total VOCs. Slide number 24. So once we installed the remedy, did the extraction, removal, installation of the wells, we talked about putting in some type of green remediation. And this was, we talked about it during the ROD, but we didn't actually install anything until, actually decide on what we were going to do until after the ROD was signed. So this was a post-ROD action. We talked about the three things that we wanted to talk about. We came up with this 3P principle. The planet, or is it going to hurt our planet, or, you know, how will it affect our, or minimize our footprint? Basically, are we just moving contaminants around, or are we creating more contaminants? Are we using extra energy? Are we using extra materials? What can we do to minimize our footprint on the planet? The second P is people. You know, are we using hazardous chemicals that would be dangerous to the workers or our community, or are we going to create some type of hazardous environment using some of these chemicals? And the third one, of course, for the contractor is person profit. How much is it going to cost? Now, again, this is not a super fund. This is actually costing the military, the DOD. This is a DOD site, so you know they're looking at how much is the remedy going to cost. Page number 25. We came up with these solar shippers. Solar shippers were primarily designed for areas where there is no electricity available. It's a solar-powered remediation system. It uses a vacuum pressure canister pump to recover the hydrocarbons through a floating hydrophobic intake filter. Basically, when the pump canister is filled, the pump reverses, which pressurizes the system and pumps the recovered fluid up to the surface, or the NAPL up to the surface into a storage vessel. In this case, it's a 55-gallon drum that they put in a container or in a little box. You'll see soon that the 55-gallon drum is stored in. Page number, slide 26. The way this operates is extracts the fluid from, it'll go down to depths of 180 feet. Now, we weren't going any deeper than about 30 feet for our system. And it can recover fluids as heavy a weight as oil. Now, we didn't use anything that heavy. The NAPL's not that heavy, of course. The solar sipper can recover both NAPL and DNAPL, the light NAPL and the dense NAPL. And we used actually the lighter mesh screen, about a 60 mesh screen. You can either use a float skimmer with that screen or use a specific gravity float, depending on whatever application you have that you're using. Slide number 27. What we use is you use an existing either a 2-inch or a 4-inch monitoring well. You can install your own well if you want, but since we already had plenty of monitoring wells, what we do is we move this unit around from well to well. If we find that it's not receiving any NAPL, then we'll move it to another well. The total weight actually is only about, is less than 60 pounds for the total unit, not counting the 55-gallon drum. As you can look, there's an intake filter that goes down basically there between the water and the hydrocarbons. There's a skimmer attachment which floats on top of the hydrocarbons. And as it sees hydrocarbons, it'll fill up that canister. The canister is not very big. I don't know the volume size, but it's a 24-inch, less than 2-inch OD diameter canister. Once that canister gets full, the pressure reverses and it'll pump up into that 55-gallon drum. Slide number 28. Oh, one other thing on this unit. The unit costs approximately $15,000 per unit, and we got five of these for this Area 18. The solar panel generates approximately 64 watts per panel. It's about 40 pounds per panel. And Missouri is not the best for solar power, but this unit doesn't require too much energy, so it works perfect for what we need. Slide number 29. Inside that unit is a 55-gallon drum. You have to, of course, put a hazardous waste label on it with a date when it starts receiving hazardous waste. And slide number 30. Here's some of the latest readings we had. It's actually about a year old, some of these values. But this is the Silt Clair aquifer. It's 8 to 32 feet below ground surface. The AOC1 north pit is down the lower left-hand side. The highest levels we were getting were about 17,000 parts per billion. And on the right side, the AOC 2 and 3, the highest levels we were getting around 30 and 40,000 parts per billion. And again, these are total VOCs. The primary contaminant is CIS-12 DCE. Slide number 31. This is the upper payload channel, which is the 32 to 65 feet below ground surface. AOC1 and North Pit, the highest readings we got were 58,000 parts per billion. And AOC 2 and 3, the highest levels we were getting were just over 100,000 parts per billion. Since the extraction wells is drawing the plume towards it, it's moved somewhat out of the main source area and is moving in a northwest general direction. Slide number 32. Here's what we've recovered through December of 2008. It's a little bit confusing. On the left side, it says volume of NAPL. That is what it was hand baled when we would sample the wells. We did hand baling of the NAPL. And so the dark blue line, we've recovered, hand-baled, we covered about 18 gallons. And on the green, which is the AOC 2 and 3, we've recovered about 105 hand-baled gallons. Now the blue line, the right side is the solar sipper, and we've recovered, as of December 2008, about 110 gallons of NAPL. Since that time, we've actually recovered about 40 more gallons, so we're up to a total of 150 total gallons of solar sipper recovered NAPL. That's all. On the last is page, slide number 33. That's all I have. If anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to entertain them.
Thanks, Clint. Does anybody in the line have a question? Can you hear me?
You can.
Yes.
This is Kate Lowe in Region 3. I guess I'm surprised that, number one, that you were able to just find such a fine layer of NAPL. So that's one question, how you found that, how you knew at what interval to place the sipper, and I'm surprised that you didn't need an oil-water phase separator.
we are not, you're talking about once the NAPL's recovered?
Right.
We didn't have it shown there, but what we were doing is we're shipping everything off site that goes into that 55-gallon drum, and there's such a small volume. We're talking 150 gallons total, you know, within the last 2 years. We're just shipping everything off site, so we weren't separating it. And as for the finding the levels, we did that when we were sampling the wells, and that will float up and down according to wherever the hydrocarbon layer. I mean, there's a float there, and it'll float up and down in that well casing as to wherever that hydrocarbon layer is.
Got you. All right, thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? I don't see any other questions in the web.
There was one question that came online, and that comes in from Houston, Texas, and they would like to know what is done with the VOC off-gas from collection in head space in the drums. Clint, I don't know if you're still on the line.
I do. Actually, I was looking back through some of my notes. There is on slide 27. There is an exhaust line that comes off of the top of that unit. And are they asking how it's filtered? You know, what kind of filtering unit is on there? I'm not sure, but there is an exhaust line that comes off of that drum. If they look on slide 27, which filters out the VOCs.
Okay, and the individual who submitted that, if you could provide any clarification, we'll see if Clint can give you a more specific answer. There was another question that came online from Houston, Texas, and actually this is two-part. And the first part asks, how much would power cost using a conventional electricity source as opposed to the $75,000 spent for the solar sippers?
You're asking a question. I'd have to get back with them if there's a chance that if they had an email, if it came online, if they could somehow submit that information, that question, or I'll be glad to get back with them. I'd have to talk with the contractor about that.
Okay.
I really don't know the difference in how much it would normally cost.
Okay. There was another part, though, where they asked, were injection wells using recovered water, the 500,000 gallons, is that right, to control the plume rather than extraction wells on the northern boundary?
Could you ask that question one more time about the extraction
wells? They said that they're making reference to a volume of water of 500,000 gallons, and they asked, were injection wells using the recovered water to control plume rather than extraction wells on the northern boundary?
The extraction well is the one that controls the plume, which goes through an airstripper on the northern boundary, not the extraction wells. I mean, not the injection wells, I mean. The injection wells are primarily for monitoring the contaminants. It'll do both. It'll inject, and you can also monitor all those wells. But all those injection wells, those 130-plus injection wells, are primarily for injecting the molasses. And it's not for controlling the plume. It's just for dechlorinating the solvent.
Okay. There's another question that came in online from Seattle, and they asked, could you elaborate how this remediation type fulfills the general 6 criteria of green remediation?
I don't know if I can do that without sending. Could I get back with them on an email on that?
Sure. What we'll do for the questions that were directed to Clint, Clint, I'll copy you on all of these and shoot you a personal email with everyone and their contact information.
Sounds good. I appreciate it.
Okay. Okay, Julie, go ahead.
Okay. We're going to proceed. The next presentation has the speaker as Dr. Sutton, but I believe there is another person that is going to be doing the presentation instead of him. I couldn't catch the name, but if they can...
Yeah, I think this is Doug Sutton speaking. I think Carlos Pachon was expecting to provide to do the presentation, but I'm filling in for him.
Okay, good. We'll proceed then. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity to share our experience in tackling the carbon footprint at the Baird and McGuire Superfund site. We're on slide 34 here. This project began a little over a year ago when Dorothy Allen, a case manager with Mass DEP, contacted Carlos at EPA regarding some technical assistance for reducing the carbon footprint at the Baird and McGuire site. And Baird and McGuire site is currently a state lead Superfund site. It was once an EPA lead site. And by the time Dorothy had called us, she'd already done carbon footprint analysis and identified some of the major contributors to it, to the overall footprint, and was looking at the idea of using combined heat and power to reduce the carbon footprint of that site and increase overall energy efficiency. We'll go to the next slide, slide 35. Now, our objectives, Carlos then hired me to help out Dorothy, and our objectives were obviously to satisfy her needs in terms of reducing that carbon footprint, providing her some ideas, and evaluating the CHP option that she talked about. But we also wanted to make sure that we documented well what we did and looked at solutions that might be applicable at other sites. Moving on to slide number 36. These next few slides provide some background on the Baird McGuire site. I'm not going to spend too much time on the background because I just want to get into the analysis that we did. But the two primary remedial actions at this site were excavation and incineration of soils and river sediments. That was completed back in 1998. And then an ongoing pump and treat system that addresses arsenic, primarily arsenic, but also some VOCs and SVOCs. And the pump and treat system as it's currently operating was obviously the focus of our study. Going on to slide number 37. The Baird McGuire site had a history of being a very expensive site. In fact, my role at the site actually first began back in 2001 when EPA hired myself and some colleagues to go do a remediation system evaluation of the site. At the time, it cost about $3.5 million a year to operate, and our evaluation identified a number of opportunities to reduce those costs, things like plant automation to reduce labor, not doing on-site laboratory analysis, but shipping samples off-site to off-site laboratories like as is commonly done, reducing security, things like that. We also had some technical recommendations with regard to some of the other treatment processes. The state took over the site from EPA in 2004, and by the time they had done that, EPA had installed implemented some of the recommendations and saved about $1.5 million as a result of that per year. The state continued to implement recommendations and knocked down that annual cost by another $1 million or so. So by the time the state was a year or so in operation, they'd reduced it from about $3.5 million a year to around $1 million a year. Slide number 38 pretty much just says exactly that. So let's move on to slide number 39. Now, in addition to implementing the RC recommendations, the state also did other things. They did a utility audit to look for areas for increased efficiencies. Installed variable frequency drives on several of the pumps, put motion sensors in there for lighting and things like that to otherwise optimize the system. Other things they did, they evaluated the capture zone several times to make sure that the amount of water that they were extracting was appropriate, not too much, not too little, that sort of thing, because obviously some efficiencies would be gained if you could extract less water. But they'd done that as well. Moving on to slide 40, we have a, we can start talking about the actual system. And it's, what we have here is a simple process flow diagram of the treatment system. Once again, it was primarily designed to treat, arsenic and then, several VOCs and SVOCs. The primary remaining organic compound or contaminant that needs to be treated is naphthalene, which does strip a little bit, but really is best, best addressed by carbon. But if you look at this, treatment, or this process flow diagram, you'll see six primary steps that we present here. There's the extraction, followed by the metals removal with, solids handling, followed by biotanks that are used as inefficient air strippers. Originally, those biotanks were intended to be bioreactors. But operation in that mode was relatively inefficient, and they decided to just operate them as inefficient air strippers, basically big tanks with bubblers in the middle of them. And then the off gas is treated by GAC. And then from there they go to pressure filters to remove some of the solids, then onto some liquid phase GAC units, and then discharge to on-site infiltration galleries. Now for each of those six steps, you'll see that we have the horsepower ratings of the various motors and whatnot that were involved with each of those processes. If you're just look purely looking at motor size, you can see the extraction system about 10.5 horsepower. There's, you know, for mixers and transfer pumps in the metal system, there's about 4.25. The biotanks have blowers with enormous motors in those, you know, 20 horsepower piece plus a 5 horsepower transfer pump. So you can see where a lot of the energy is being used at the site. Moving on to the next slide, which is slide number 41. Just a picture of the biotanks so you can get an appreciation for what they look like. Just basically large steel tanks. You can't see inside them, but they're some concentric design for various to improve contact time. They're about 172,000 gallons apiece. And the next slide, slide 42, just a picture inside the plant. It's a fairly large plant, but right there in the front are the GAC units. They're about 10,000 pounds apiece. There's about 8,000 pounds per changeout. And what's interesting at this site is despite relatively low organic concentrations in the process flow, those units are changed out 8 times a year. So they're using about 64,000 or so pounds of carbon per year, which is a lot. And it's indicative of changeouts being done as a result of fouling and solids loading rather than actual chemical loading. And just to the side of that picture, you can actually see some of the types of carbon that were used. I think just most recently it looks like they were using a reactivated carbon, not a virgin carbon. Moving on to the next slide, slide 43, is where we start to talk about the concept here. Now, when Dorothy had called us, remember she'd already done a carbon footprint analysis and identified the GAC units and the biotanks, or those inefficient air strippers, as being the primary contributors to the carbon footprint, which is easily seen there. And as far as evaluating the carbon, she used a number of 6.45 pounds of carbon dioxide equivalents per pound of GAC that's used. She borrowed that from another study, and to this date, we have not seen a backup for that number. So that number could be significantly higher, significantly lower. It's still a source of question, but we use that at least as a placeholder for this analysis, recognizing that our results could change if that number, or if we were to find a different value for that number. And the thought that she had was, if I can eliminate those GAC units and basically use a more efficient, say, tray aerator for air stripping and heat the process water, then the air stripper would be able to remove the naphthalene, and then she wouldn't need the carbon units anymore. So it would be improving air stripper efficiency and getting rid of the carbon units all at one time. And then obviously providing heat or heating that much water is a energy intensive process. But she put two and two together and thought about using combined heat and power for basically generating electricity at the site and then using the waste heat for heating that process water. So that was the idea that kicked off the study. And if we move to the next slide, which is 44, we can see some of the parameters that we used for the study. That's the first thing we had to do was talk about what kind of carbon dioxide, you know, carbon footprint parameters would be associated with electricity, the usage for running motors and blowers and pumps and whatnot, natural gas usage, because there's a lot of natural gas that's actually heating the plant, being that it's in Massachusetts. a number for the GAC, which I already mentioned is one that was borrowed from another store study, but we don't have good backup for it. And then a nominal number for some travel to and from the site, given that the ideas that we could talk about could result in more frequent or less frequent visits to the site for O&M purposes. We also assigned cost parameters because we did want to take into account cost here. It was kind of a twofold study, what would be the most give us the best reduction in carbon footprint, but also reasonable cost. And these cost parameters here are specific to the site. Some of you in other parts of the country may be abhorred by the electricity prices there, but that's what they pay up in the Northeast. Moving on to the next slide, which would be 45. We have a little table that shows the breakdown of the carbon footprint amongst various treatment processes, as well as the cost to operate them. And the way this is presented here is O&M labor is considered a whole separate category, and it could have been appropriate to distribute the O&M labor across the various components, but in this case, for simplicity, we just kept it as its own category. Now, if you look at the various bars and across here, you can see that the biggest contributors to the carbon footprint were the extraction and equalization steps, the inefficient air stripping, the GAC, which was the big one, but may be sensitive to that number, and then the building, which primarily is the lighting and the heating, especially the heating in the winter. Now, as far as cost, all those cost numbers are extremely low, except for they're all overwhelmed by the O&M labor, which we could reduce O&M visits, but I think what you'd see is that wouldn't necessarily cut back on your carbon footprint. What we're really trying to do is reduce energy usage and reduce materials usage. The total numbers up there at the top of the chart, 787 tons of carbon dioxide per year and $784,000 per year. That does not include things like consulting fees and groundwater monitoring and meetings and things like that. That's purely for just operating the plant. Moving on to slide number 46, we can talk about the various options that we decided to look at as a result of the initial ideas that Dorothy provided, plus some other potential options. One was to try to eliminate airstripping altogether and to go with a GAC-only treatment, which would be probably the most appropriate for dealing with naphthalene, and hopefully the most simple, if you could get that solid loading down. Eliminate the GAC and go to go with the air stripping only, but provide enough air-to-water ratio that you're getting rid of the naphthalene without any heating. And then the enhanced air stripping with waste heat from a combined heat and power unit, which was Dorothy's original idea. And then considering some additional options, specifically a water source heat pump, to provide heat for the building rather than relying on natural gas. So those are the options that we looked at, and once again we considered both cost and carbon footprint. So moving on to slide number 47, I'm going to skip a lot. I don't have a lot of calculations and whatnot in this presentation, not a lot of spreadsheets, but mostly the summary tables and charts. We show what the GAC only with maybe if we can get away with 50% reduction on GAC usage by improving our solids handling ahead of the GAC units, and then also an air stripping option. And you see in all these cases carbon footprint numbers of 665 or 554 for if we could get a reduction in the GAC usage, and 661. And remember, those numbers compare to a baseline carbon footprint of about 787 that we showed on the previous page. So all of these options, which really rely on conventional treatment technologies, but using them and addressing inefficiencies and just using them more appropriately, would result in a carbon footprint reduction, and also cost reductions. Remember, all those numbers are compared to the 784,000. But you could see that the percentage decrease for carbon footprint far exceeds the percentage decrease in cost. So, if you're going to make those kind of changes, what you're really doing is targeting the carbon footprint with some minor cost savings rather than vice versa. Moving on to the next slide, which would be 48. We have a chart that shows the effect of increasing the water temperature and how that relates to stripping effectiveness, hair stripping effectiveness. So certainly people up in Massachusetts have a harder time of in terms of stripping VOCs and whatnot than people, say, in the southeast or other parts of the country where the groundwater is warmer. But in any case, if you were to artificially heat your water, your air stripping efficiency would increase as well. The parameters on this chart are parameters that are somewhat appropriate for the Baird McGuire site. Flow of about 120 GPM. We selected an airflow of 900 CFM, six tray air stripper unit, and an influent concentration of about 800 micrograms per liter. And all this is just done with the vendor software with no safety factor associated with it. And you can see that with an influent concentration of 800, as you go, as you heat your influent water, that effluent concentration decreases substantially. So that's the whole concept behind the original idea of heating that process water, with the idea of increasing air stripping efficiency and getting away from the GAC units. Moving on to slide number 49, we provide a kind of a simplified process flow diagram of what it would look like to provide this heat-enhanced air stripping. On the first box is the same thing. It's the water coming from the metals removal system. So for all these cases, what we're doing is we're just focusing on basically the air stripping and the GAC, because the metals removal is going to sit there and do what it needs to do regardless. It also has a relatively minor impact on the carbon footprint compared to the other technologies. So water coming from the metals removal system would be heated from some heat source. Heated water would then go into the air stripper. It would remove VOCs, but at the same time would cool some of that water because of the air and the water contact. The clean water would then pass through a heat exchanger so that much of that heat could be transferred back to the water before the air stripper, so that we're not losing a lot of that heat through the discharge and discharging warm water. Moving on to slide 50, introduces the concept of combined heat and power. And for those of you who are not familiar with the technology, it's basically generating electricity, in this case generating electricity on-site with a natural gas-fired turbine or reciprocating engine. And then instead of losing the heat through exhaust and jacket temperature, what you're doing is you are using that heat beneficially to heat the process water in this case. So rather than losing that heat to the environment, we're using it constructively. And the overall efficiency of using the fuel, using that natural gas, goes from about, say, 35% or so up to about 75%. Electricity that we'd get over the grid, sometimes that's recovered for combined heat and power at the plant. Sometimes it's used for combined cycles, but sometimes it just isn't very efficiently used. But in this case, what we're trying to do is maximize that use by using that waste heat. Now, if we move on to slide 51, we modify that previous process flow diagram that we had by putting in the combined heat and power unit. And in this case, there's also a boiler as well. And it turns out that a combined heat and power unit cannot provide, based on the electricity that it needs to generate in order to run the plant, it cannot provide enough heat to heat the process water enough to do what we wanted it to do. So there was a small boiler that was also added in there to provide the remaining heat that was needed, at least to use just one reasonably sized air stripper. So other than that, it's the same thing. It's the heated water that's coming out of the air stripper, heated but clean water that's coming out of the air stripper goes through the heat exchanger, so a lot of that heat can be returned to the system rather than discharged. And once again, the CHP unit in this case cannot handle, cannot provide enough heat because it just doesn't have the electrical demand there. Now, you could operate the CHP unit at its full load and provide that power, say, back to the grid or back to some other location, but that typically is not very very cost effective. You really want to try to match up as best as you can the heat and the electrical demand. Moving on to slide 52, we can see what the summary is of some of the results of these options. The CHP unit is the one on the first. That's the first column, and we have it reports out a carbon footprint of about 573. Remember, that is compared to that baseline of 787 and some of those earlier numbers that we talked to. It's not quite as good as reducing or going with a GAC-only system if you can reduce the GAC usage by 50%, but nevertheless a big improvement next to the baseline, and reduced annual operating costs as well. Now, to look at the idea between using CHP and using some other heat source, if you were to just use a boiler for this, not combine heat and power, but to use grid electricity and then use natural gas to heat that water, you'd end up with a worse situation. Actually, it'd cost you more, and it would increase your carbon footprint. And I think that's probably pretty obvious that that would be the outcome, or else you'd find a lot more people doing this exact approach to get rid of VOCs and SVOCs. And then we also include the GAC-only option here just for comparison. But in any case, we're seeing improvement, but it's worth looking at things a little bit closer. So on the next slide, which would be 53, we talk about adding the combined heat and power, which we had before, but then adding in a water source heat pump on the plant effluent. And what that water source heat pump does, this would be after the heat exchanger, is it would replace the need to use natural gas for building heat. A water source heat pump is the same technology that is typically used in geothermal heat pump applications or ground source heat pump applications. It's the idea of it's almost like an air conditioner that uses water instead of air. And it can operate in reverse. So it's just like if you're trying to cool your house, if you go outside and feel the air conditioner compressor, you'll find that if there's a lot of heat coming off of that. Well, if you were to reverse those things and you were to cool the outside, you'd be able to heat your house. It's much the same thing here with a water source heat pump, only it's much more efficient than an air source heat pump or air conditioner. So the idea is, now the other aspect of this is that a heat pump uses electricity. So by using this, we're providing more efficient heat to the building, and we're also increasing the electrical demand to the facility. And that electrical demand then allows that CHP unit to operate at a higher load, which means it can generate heat. And in this case, it actually does provide enough heat to provide the heat that's needed, provides the electricity to run the heat pump, and provides more efficient heating for the building. So that's what this slide basically summarizes there, and you can go through the numbers, but I don't want to do that now. So if we look, what are the results of doing this thing, and how does it compare to other options? Let's move to the next slide. Slide 54. There are our bar graphs right there, and we have the old standard CHP option with a carbon footprint of 573, and then we come over with a CHP heat pump up. With the one we just discussed, that would be 514. So it reduces things by, say, another 10% or more, 10 to 15%. And then the GAC-only option is provided there just for comparison. So incrementally, we've been improving our carbon footprint here, reducing it with each step of the way. But also, I'm sure many of the process engineers in the audience are recognizing this. You're making a substantially more complicated system, which certainly has its drawbacks. So it may look good on paper, but then the question is, how would that actually perform? How many upsets would you have? What are the troubles associated with heating this process water? And how does that compare to just using our traditional technologies more effectively? But let's turn to the next page, next slide. Slide 55. And right here we just have a table that's summarizing the reduction in carbon footprint and the reduction in annual costs associated with each of the options. And they're arranged in increasing order. So the CHP, increasing order with respect to carbon footprint. But the types of reductions that we're noticing are impressive. I mean, when you look at executive orders and other things out there that aim for a 20% reduction in greenhouse gases by a certain time period, it's these kind of modifications that could actually get you there. And there are cost savings associated with them, but as I mentioned before, the cost savings are minor compared to the percent reduction in the carbon footprint. So you really need to set out with the idea of reducing the carbon footprint if you want to do that, and then recognize that there may be some payback or may not be in some cases. And the next slide actually does look at the payback options. What we have is the baseline, the GAC only, the air stripping, combined heat and power, the GAC only, assuming you can get a 50% reduction in the GAC usage, and then the CHP with the heat pump. And those are arranged in decreasing carbon footprint, so that the best option, at least with respect to that, would be over on the right-hand side. Cost is the other indicator that's presented. It's just, those just fall where they may. And you can see, and then this is payback, not cost, but payback. And what you can see is that the GAC only and the GAC only with a 50% reduction, those have incredibly short paybacks. So we're talking about a year or so. That really would turn into good savings when you take into account the capital cost that's required to make the changes. And then the savings you get on a year in, year out basis, you're really looking at an improvement there and actually long-term savings for the site. For the other ones, like the CHP option and the CHP with the heat pump, we've got paybacks that are in the 9 to 11-year period. And some people might say, well, okay, well, that's great. We'll have savings after year 9 or 11. But remember that there's going to be a period where equipment will only last for so long. There's going to need to be replacements and things like that. So I think the best way to envision those options is that they provide you a carbon footprint reduction and pay for themselves. Because by the time they actually pay for themselves, it's time to reinvest, and then you'll end up trying to pay off that option again in the future. So, I guess the point is that you can have some, you can get some carbon footprint reductions and pay for it, and in some cases actually, save some money over the long term. So that about wraps up the analysis. In the next two slides, I only have two more left, talk about our conclusions, and then we can, field some questions. So our second to last slide here, I guess it's the third to last with the overall presentation. Conclusions regarding carbon footprint analysis. Labor is a high cost, but has a relatively low footprint, especially if your plant operator is relatively local, which in most pump and treat systems that I visit across the country, that's typically the case. There's not a huge commute involved with it. The big contributors are your electricity usage for pumps and blowers and whatnot. And also materials. Materials actually have a pretty high footprint associated with them. And I think it is important to include materials when you do these types of analyses. For a simple reason, let's look at a simple air stripping option. Well, you can remove VOCs with an air stripper, or you can remove VOCs with carbon. If we were to not include materials in these carbon footprint analyses, then the air stripper, or then the GAC option would almost always win, because the air stripper option is going to use a lot more electricity to run the blower and to remove the VOCs in that manner. There actually is a decent carbon footprint associated with GAC. We may not know the actual number, but it is a decent one, and so the material does need to be considered when we do these types of analyses. Let's see here. The carbon footprint for things like travel and electricity and natural gas, those are pretty easy to calculate. There's good numbers out there for those. But when it comes to materials, even though it is important to include them, like I just mentioned, it's hard to find good numbers for it. It's not like manufacturers are spitting out those numbers left and right in an easily publicly available form. There are life cycle databases out there. There's the NREL one. The National Renewable Energy Lab has a life cycle database. And Europe has a decent life cycle database. But these typically don't include, you know, they include some things. They include chlorine and PVC and HDPE, things like that. But they do not include things like GAC and many of the other treatment chemicals that you might come across in groundwater remediation. So carbon footprinting should, and overall environmental footprinting, you know, when we talk about those other elements, should really consider materials, but we've got to find a way to find some better numbers for what those materials are so that we can account for them more accurately when we do these studies. And I already mentioned the uncertainties associated with the GAC footprint, so there's no reason to dwell on it other than it would certainly depend on the type of GAC that you're using. A good portion of the footprint from virgin GAC would be the actual oxidation of the coal that is used as a feedstock. So you might start off with a pound of coal, but you need to oxidize about 50% of it or possibly even more in order to make it activated. And so all that coal that you're oxidizing to get that is basically turning into carbon dioxide that's entering the atmosphere and adding to that carbon footprint. So obviously if you were to use coconut shell-based GAC, you wouldn't have that same option because the stuff that you're oxidizing and burning off grew from a plant which will be reabsorbed when another plant grows in its place. And then reactivated GAC, certainly you're not going to have that initial coal burn off at the beginning, or you would, but you'd be able to use a lot of that coal over and, or a lot of that carbon over and over again. And in the end, the carbon footprint would be lower for that regenerated carbon. But nevertheless, still need to figure out some better numbers for that. Moving on to my last slide and the second to last slide of the seminar. Let's look at some conclusions regarding the technology. The combined heat and power coupled with the heat exchangers looks on paper to be a pretty good approach for this site. Like I said, there's some other complicating factors in terms of how would that affect system reliability, but nevertheless, it does show that if you were to use a technology like that, that it could reduce that, has a good potential to reduce the carbon footprint. And although it may not have been best for, say, naphthalene, it might be really effective for things like MTBE or 1,2-dichloroethane or 1,1,2-trichloroethane that don't strip very well and don't sorb the carbon very well. In those kind of cases, maybe heating the process water with CHP would improve, would sufficiently improve air stripper efficiency that it becomes a more overall efficient and environmentally friendly option. So even though it wasn't it wouldn't be my choice of technologies here, it might actually be more advantageous for other sites with other chemical constituents. And then obviously if we're heating water, you have to consider some of the disadvantages of that. Obviously for your treatment plant to operate effectively, it needs to come up to temperature. So if you have extended periods of shutdown, you're not going to be able to get it back up to its full operating mode until you increase it to its operating temperature, which may take some time. And then also with some of the compounds and elements that we're finding in our groundwater, you may have increased fouling at some locations if you're planning on heating your water. So certainly you want to do some water quality and wet chemistry analysis to figure out what your scale potential is and how the temperature might affect that before making a big investment. That summarizes where I guess in the last one is that heat pumps for building heating. It's a great application. When I think of geothermal heat pumps, which I've done various designs and feasibility studies for those, over and over again, the limiting factor for, say, geothermal heat pumps is the cost of providing that water or the cost of the cost of installing the ground loops, the HDPE loops that are installed in the ground. That's the highest part. It adds a lot to the capital cost. And for pump and treat systems, we have, water readily available that we have to extract, that we have to treat, and that we have to do something with. And so if you can borrow the heat from that with a heat pump and use it constructively, seems like it has a pretty good payback associated with it and increased efficiency. So that's all I have, and I'm happy to field questions.
Thanks, Doug. I will open up to the phone lines to see if there's any question for Dr. Sisson.
Yeah, hi, Doug. This is Maria Watt from CDM.
Uh-huh.
I have a question on, do you go all the way back to like a Tier 3 indirect and Tier 3 greenhouse gas emissions for all your materials, or where did you draw the line?
We drew the line, like for electricity, we got it from EGRID, and EGRID just basically gives you the emission factor associated with combusting the fuel to create the electricity. It doesn't include transmission losses the energy required to operate the plant. It doesn't include the energy to harvest the fuels or anything like that. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, but certainly for this study, we felt that it was sufficient to do that.
Right. Your manufacturing of materials is difficult to go back and get accurate numbers.
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely, it is, and that's. I think that's one of the biggest issues we're going to face when we do, whether it's carbon footprinting or other aspects of it as well, because you can imagine part of the six core elements that were mentioned on the phone earlier. We only tackled the carbon one here, but there's other ones that go along with that, whether it's NOx and SOx or hazardous air pollutants that are being emitted to the air, or whether it's water usage that goes into manufacturing chemicals and things like that. All that stuff is pretty hard to track down unless there's a decent studies done to do that. And like I said, there are life cycle databases out there, but they don't include a lot of the stuff that we need as remedial engineers. to do these studies at least accurately. There's always going to be some sensitivity analysis and some uncertainty in the results that we get.
Great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Is there another question on the phone line? I understand there is a question in the through the web. If I can read it, it says, good analysis. This question comes from William Gilbert from California Department of Toxic Substances in Sacramento. He says, good analysis. Is there any difference in the fate of removed naphthalene between stripping the GAC and GAC?
Any difference in the fate? Well, it's a good question. I think with the air stripping, we were assuming that it would be, the air stripping would be treated with off-gas with GAC, but you use a lot less GAC for that air strip or off-gas, especially because we don't have all the fouling issues and whatnot. So ultimately, that GAC would be reactivated just as the liquid phase GAC. So I think ultimately, the fate is going to be the same. They're both going to end up in the furnace at the GAC reactivation center. It's just that with the air stripping option, whichever one you choose, you're going to end up regenerating or reactivating a lot less carbon for this particular site. That wouldn't necessarily hold for all sites.
Thank you. I did have a question on my own. Do you recall in to do like an optimization of the system?
My firm supports Technology Innovation Office, or you know, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation through one of their contracts. And so when this came up, when Dorothy approached Carlos, Carlos was in the process of looking for, I don't want to speak for him too much, but I understand he was in the process of looking for potential pilot studies to document, ways of doing carbon footprinting and applying technologies to reduce carbon footprints and just overall green remediation. So I think that he was willing to help Dorothy in this case, given that their interests overlapped. And just as my function as a support contractor, he came to me.
Okay.
And well, I guess, I mean, I have experience in this stuff anyway, so I guess it was a natural fit for it.
So you are working as a support contract for Carlos?
Our contract is with is an OzReady contract. It's specifically
okay.
The Technology Innovation Field Services Division. That's it's the Tetra Tech contract.
Okay, good.
That's who the contract I'm working through.
I was just wondering if this kind of analysis is available for other sites.
You call Carlos. I think he's out of the country right now, which is why I'm doing this for him. But I understand that he is still looking for other pilot sites. I've done several others with him. So I think that I would assume there are, but I don't want to speak for him.
Okay.
Hi, this is Kirby Diggs. I'm one of Carlos's associates, and I work on green remediation with him in the Technology Innovation Field Services Division. And I think the answer to that is yes. We are still looking for pilots. I am working on one myself. So there may be a possibility. I'm not saying that we're going to be able to do all pilots, but I think we would probably be open to looking at additional pilots.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other question? I don't see any other questions in the website.
No, that's about it, Julie. I don't think there's any more online.
Okay, well, if there's no other questions, I think this concludes our session for today. As I said before, most of the information you're going to be able to get them back probably within 1 or 2 weeks after today. And if you are interested or need more information, you can contact any of the people that presented today, including myself. So I would like to thank all the speakers today for participating and for everybody that participated through either the phone lines or the internet. Also, we'd like to remind everybody that this is only the first of 3 sessions. The second one is going to be November 12th, and the third is going to be December 5th. So if you're participating in the other 2 sessions, please sign in through www.glowin.org. And also don't forget to fill out the feedback form. Thanks, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.